from NPR and WBUR and Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. 9 years in a penal colony. That's the sentence a Russian judge handed down today to American basketball star Brittany Griner for carrying cannabis-infused vape cartridges in her luggage when she entered Russia back in February to play in the off-season there. An American diplomat in Russia called it a miscarriage of justice. Mary Ilushina is covering the story for our editorial partners, The Washington Post. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
And we know Russian courts are tough, U.S.-Russian relations that are a low point, but this sentence was almost the maximum. Is that a surprise?
Well, unfortunately, it is not very surprising. We know it's a very high-profile case, and given the relationship that Moscow and Washington are experiencing right now, this was expected. It is pretty high considering the amount of cannabis she brought into the country. It was just above the threshold that constitutes it a significant amount under Russian law. So her defense was arguing for leniency, but the court has dismissed all of their arguments and said that Griner deliberately smuggled narcotics into the country.
Yeah, and of course she says this is what she uses for pain. And she apologized to her teammates, but also had this to say just before her sentencing.
I know everybody keeps talking about political pawn and politics, but I hope that that is far from this courtroom. I want to say again that I had no intent on breaking any Russian laws.
Well, she may hope it's far from this courtroom, but is it thought that this is politics, that this is about Russia leveraging a prisoner swap? You know, President Biden called the sentence unacceptable, but that raises the question, well, if you don't accept it, what are you going to do about it? So how much is politics a part of this?
I think politics is probably the crucial part here because Russia has a precedent of sort of using the American nationals that are in Russian custody as bargaining chips with the United States to try and get back some of the Russian nationals that the United States has. And oftentimes the charges brought against those people are very mismatched because, for example, with the previous swab, we had Trevor Reed, who says he doesn't even remember what he did, but he was given a pretty long sentence. And again, with Griner and her potential swap, her charge is smuggling drugs in a really low amount. And the proposed swap that the United States is probably considering right now, as far as we know from the reporting, is that Russia would want to get back Viktor Bout, who is convicted of 25 years for arms dealerships. Mm-hmm. He is a very notorious arms dealer, and he's often referred to as merchant of death. So it is, unfortunately, there is a precedent of Russia doing this.
Yeah. Does Griner have a path to appeal?
She does. She can appeal. She has, I think it's 10 days to appeal, and her team has said that they are absolutely going to appeal, and they think this sentence is completely outrageous, and it's too severe for, given all the circumstance around her case. She is going to continue to stay in the current detention center that she is in now, but if the sentencing comes into force, she will be most likely moved to another colony further away from Moscow, which will make it more difficult for the U.S. Embassy staff, for example, yeah, to communicate with her.
Well, we recently spoke with Galina Lembersky, who'd spent time in a Russian penal colony on a trumped-up charge. This was a labor camp, and it was back in the 80s, and it was horrendous. You know, here we have Griner, who is a 6'9" black lesbian in Russia, where there's a law banning what Russian law calls promoting non-traditional sexual relationships. So how horrendous do you expect in the minute we have this experience could be?
Well, it's definitely going to be very traumatic for her. That is without a doubt. There is a lot of concern regarding how her inmates may treat her, given her background, given her sexuality, because, there is a lot of problematic laws in Russia and sort of the general attitude towards people from the LGBT community is not the most welcoming. So it is obviously very, very concerning. The conditions of the prison itself, it's difficult to assess now because we don't know exactly which prison it's going to be, and they do vary sort of in the severity of these conditions. We know that she's not going to be held in a high-security prison, which are sort of the most tough within the Russian system. So that is a slight consolation here. But obviously we'll have to look at where exactly she might end up if the appeal doesn't come through.
Mary Ilyushina, a contributor to The Washington Post, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, a politician with strong ties to Russia is giving a marquee speech today in Dallas. Hungary's hardline leader, Viktor Orban, is speaking to a group of Republicans from the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC. Orban's nationalistic views and his calls for racial purity have divided Europe, but his tactics have also inspired people like Donald Trump and conservative U.S. media. Kim Lane Shepley is a professor at Princeton University. She studies the ties that bind the GOP with Viktor Orban. Kim, thanks for joining us.
Lovely to talk to you.
So with Viktor Orban speaking in front of a prominent group of Republicans today in Texas, what are you watching for?
Well, I'd be interested in seeing how much Orban is going to lead with the dog whistle culture wars that he shares so much with the Republican Party. But more recently, Orban's been trying to develop his general grand theory of the world, in which the West, what he now calls the post-West, is failing. The U.S. and Europe are failing, and powers like Russia and China are rising.
Let's just step back for a moment. I understand you have met him. You've obviously tracked his politics for many years. Just remind people what kind of leader he is, because I know there are organizations around the world who follow his government who don't even really consider Hungary a democracy anymore.
Well, almost all the democracy rating agencies all say that Hungary is no longer a democracy. And Orban's been on this track for some time. Orban started in politics right around the time of the fall of the wall, and he started as a libertarian conservative. He shifted to where he thought the voters were, and so he gradually became a nationalist, and then he became a sort of intolerant white nationalist. And by the time he was elected in 2010, he had really perfected appealing to the Hungarian public as a kind of wounded victim of globalization. And once he was elected in a free and fair election in 2010, he then changed all the election rules so that now it's impossible to get rid of him through free and fair elections. And so he's just won his fourth election in a row, the last three of which were heavily rigged.
Well, Orban recently gave a pretty alarming speech promoting racial purity. And this is a quote. He said, "We do not want to become peoples of mixed race." One of his top advisors resigned in protest. So it sounds like you're saying that the longer Viktor Orban is in power, the more extreme he's becoming.
Yeah, so his speech that he gave in Romania a couple of weeks ago was surprising, because even though he's always leaned into this idea of not mixing peoples, what got people excited in Hungary was that he used the language of 1930s and 40s anti-Semitism to refer to races as if they're separate species. So he switched his language in Hungarian, and therefore alarmed some of his advisors who thought he'd really crossed a line.
So after everything you've just described, the fundamental question is, why is he speaking in Texas to a group of Republicans? Why do people like Tucker Carlson on Fox News lift him up? Why does Donald Trump promote him? What does the Republican Party want with Viktor Orban?
Well, Viktor Orban and Hungary have become to the Republican Party proof of concept that a certain model works. And the model is, you know, lead with culture wars, whip up your base with culture wars, and then manipulate the rules so that even though you don't have majority support in the public, you can go on winning elections. And I think this is really a formula the Republicans have been eyeing with some jealousy, and they're trying to learn from Orban.
And you have even said that Donald Trump and the Republican Party under the former president is using Viktor Orban's playbook. Can you explain what you mean?
Well, there are lots of ways in which Trump and Trump's supporters have copied directly things that Viktor Orban has done. And one of the new things is that there's apparently now a plan, if the Republicans come back to power in the presidency, to infiltrate the civil service with their own people by firing lots of civil servants who may not be completely on board with their program. And that was something that Viktor Orban did when he first came to power in 2010. He suspended operation of the civil service law. He fired a huge swath of the civil service that wasn't with his party. Then he reinstated the civil service law and put in all of his own people so that if anyone else happened to win an election, they couldn't dislodge his folks. And what you now see are Steve Bannon running these kind of boot camps, training thousands of people to go into the federal government, assuming that these jobs have been basically wiped out and removed from civil service protection. It's exactly the Orban playbook. And Steve Bannon is someone who's also close friends with Orban. So you see the connections directly.
Kim Lane Shepley is an expert on Hungarian politics at Princeton University. Thank you so much.
Lovely to talk to you.
Turning now to Haiti, where over a year after the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, conditions have become much more dangerous. Wiedler Mirancourt is the editor-in-chief of Aibo Post, a Haitian news service. He's in Port-au-Prince. And Wiedler, it's hard to overstate how difficult it is in Haiti right now. Food insecurity, gangs are consolidating power, kidnappings intensifying. Describe what your country's facing.
We are talking about, for instance, just for this month, the gang clashes in Cité Soleil, the largest slum in Port-au-Prince. About 500 people were either killed or wounded or disappeared in their homes, and about 3,000 people are displaced by this violence. We are talking about a situation where the kidnapping situation is more than concerning. Human rights organizations are reporting that this situation reached a level that they never seen in years. And on top of that, we have about 5 million people who are in critical need of, you know, humanitarian assistance. We have different parts of the country being unreachable because of gangs' activities.
Tell us more about these gangs, because we're reading that they're raising neighborhoods, raping women and girls, holding up goods at ports.
There is no one aspect of Haitian life that is not being impacted right now by the gang violence. The capital, Port-au-Prince, which is the center for the economic activities, the political activities here, is increasingly being isolated from the rest of the country. For instance, I was talking earlier about going to the south of the country that gives you access, a road, the Martisan Road, that gives you access to at least three departments, is practically closed. The north of the country, which hosts like the second biggest city of Haiti, Cap Haitien, this region is also increasingly being unreachable, where the gangs that control these roads, they kidnapped people, they ransack businesses. They, if you try to cross with a truck, for instance, full of merchandises or goods, they will take it and sometimes kill the drivers, or they kidnap the driver and you have to pay to release the driver and have your truck back. And in this situation, you have businesses that cannot operate, and they have to lay off people and send them home. And it's part one of the causes of the mass migration that we are observing right now.
There's a question of U.S. involvement. The U.S. hasn't always been successful in helping Haiti. You said one thing the U.S. could do is pass stricter gun control laws to help stop some of the violence in Haiti, as a lot of the guns come into Haiti illegally from the U.S.
Recently, a couple of weeks back, several containers filled with, guns and ammunition were intercepted, actually, by U.S. customs. And these equipments were sent illegally from the U.S. to Haiti. So clearly there is something that the U.S. can do in terms of helping fight against illegal guns, illegal trafficking of guns, but also in terms of controlling the gun problem that the U.S. has.
Yeah. Meantime, what are people saying to you? What do people talk about? What's the mood?
When you talk to them, they are angry at the prime minister that promised to stabilize the country. But in more than a year in power, the situation got worse. Yeah. And as his administration is not producing the results people expect, they are starting to become more and more agitated. We are observing, for instance, a couple of protests in the capital, but also in some other cities.
Widlor Mirakor, editor-in-chief of Aibo Post, the Haitian news service, speaking to us from Port-au-Prince. Thank you so much for speaking to us about what sounds like a pretty desperate time there. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, all around the world, barber shops have always been known as a place where people gather to get a shave and a trim, maybe exchange a little gossip. But what if it were more than that? A group called the Confess Project is encouraging Black men and boys to speak openly with their barbers about the problems in their lives. The rate of suicide among young Black Americans is sharply on the rise, and the idea is that these specially trained barbers can get their customers to open up and offer help when they're hurting. Craig Charles is one of those barbers. He's owner of Crown Cuts Academy in Johnson City, Tennessee. Craig, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. And, you know, I bet in some ways a lot of men can relate to this. You sit down in the chair after a long day and you just start saying stuff that you wouldn't say otherwise. What is it about barbers?
Well, barbers have a sense of comfort. Over time, you build relationships with your clients, and that adds a sense of comfort where you get comfortable, where you're able to express yourself in certain manners.
I bet you're also, you know, after several years, you're pretty good at reading a room or a face when someone comes in that door and sits in your chair.
I mean, yeah, pretty much you can tell a temperature when someone's coming in, what's on their mind through their facial expression, their body language, and you can kind of see how tense they are when they sit down, what's going on throughout that day or that week or that month.
So tell me a story about something that you heard from someone. You know, what have people opened up to you about?
People have opened up on several things. Their kids, how to resolve problems, going through divorces, basic things as far as just daily life, the daily struggles in life.
And how do you respond? Because, I mean, you're trained in this program, but you're not a licensed therapist. You're a barber.
Oh, by far. I mean, well, the four things we base ourselves on is active listening. Through active listening, then comes a positive communication. And after the positive communication, you validate people's feelings. And that's the third point. And then the fourth point is reducing the stigma.
There's a lot of stigma, isn't there? I mean, there's a stigma telling men not to talk about their feelings, especially among Black men and boys.
I mean, for so long, it's kind of taboo, and it's kind of just through years of just trauma, just hearing that you're the man of the house, and without just so many young men growing up without a father and just being raised by a single parent, that's tough. So in turn, all you hear growing up is, you're the man of the house. You're the man of the house. You have to take care of me. You have to take care of the household. And if you have little brothers and sisters and siblings, you kind of have a heart and you care for that. And over time, that just calluses you up. And it puts you in a position of vulnerability where you're not ready for all of that.
How do you break it down?
I mean, through conversation, just easing their mind, letting them know, hey, it's okay. Because trauma is real. And I go to a specialist through therapy, for therapy, just kind of calm my mind and let them understand, if I can do it, you can do it as well.
It's been a tough few years for you, for your clients, for everyone, really. I mean, there's the pandemic, which hit Black families harder. There's the murder of George Floyd. We're having deep conversations, troubling conversations sometimes about systemic racism in this country. Do those issues come up? I mean, how do you help people manage that?
That's it's funny you say that, because in the barbershop, that's one of the few places where you can be at ease and have those conversations, because those conversations come up all the time. And you have to be ready to kind of give an honest opinion and kind of soothe some tension, because a lot of times you find yourself in a barbershop being the mediator between two conversations that's going on.
Tell me more. What do you mean?
Well, a lot of times conversations happens while two clients are in two separate barber chairs. And it kind of brings up a situation where it becomes like now a community conversation where the barbers and all the clients and even people who are waiting chimes in. So it becomes just a viable conversation, just kind of ease the tension, and it always comes to a resolve. Because as much as we want to build our community, we go to the barbershop and we solve issues as well.
So do you think having those types of conversations with your clients together, almost as a community in a barbershop, I mean, is it helping?
I think it helps. I mean, because the barbershop, again, it's almost like a country club for men, for young boys of color. It's an opportunity to go and express yourself, get some, just some pick-me-upper from an adult. People are just like you. People talk like you. They sound like you. And they're able to kind of orate and just feel the things that you're going through.
Do you help people get help from a professional therapist? I mean, does it lead to that, or are these just conversations?
No, by far, we have phone numbers and we have posters in the shop to let people know, hey, you know what? I am not a therapist. I'm not a specialist, but I can bridge the gap. And this is someone, this is someone's phone number right here who can help you. And we do that all the time. And if, I mean, I've had barbers call me and say, Craig, do you remember that phone number that we had for that therapist? I'm like, yeah, I have it right here. Just, I know someone who needs it real bad.
Wow. It's a lot more than a haircut, isn't it? Craig Charles, owner of the Crown Cuts Academy in Johnson City, Tennessee, and a barber ambassador for the Confess Project. Craig, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate that.
And if you or someone you know is in crisis or considering suicide, call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. One of the world's largest employers is feeling the pain of this uncertain economy and is cutting back its workforce. Walmart says it's laying off about 200 corporate employees. Just a few days ago, the retail giant reported a rather pessimistic outlook for the rest of 2022, and its stock took a nosedive as a result. Let's unpack what this might say about our economy. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, is here. Ali, welcome back.
Thanks, Scott.
Now, we've got to start with some context here. More than 2 million people work at Walmart around the world, so 200 layoffs really barely registers. But help us understand what Walmart is up against.
That's right. It's 2.3 million worldwide, more than 1.6 million in the U.S. It's the largest private employer of all. So, yeah, in context, 200 corporate employees is not very meaningful. However, Walmart is a bellwether for everything going on in the economy. So if Walmart does anything, you want to know whether it's a trend. It's a micro example of something else that's going on. And Walmart, as you said, has warned that there are issues. They're saying that everyday necessities are eating up more of household budgets because of inflation. That's leaving shoppers with less money to spend on things that they want to buy, such as clothing, for instance. So Walmart, remember, it sells groceries, it sells clothing, it sells everything. And as a result, it has extra inventory of some stuff left over. Now, interest rates have been rising in an effort to stem inflation. That's also affecting people because if they were going to borrow or they were going to put it on a credit card and not fully pay it off, that now becomes a much bigger expense that's also cutting in. So Walmart is telling us that there's a large problem with the economy and a little reorganization going on at Walmart.
I was just going to say, the company says this is about restructuring, but it sounds like that might be code for something else.
It might be. These are often an opportunity for a company that wanted to downsize a particular division or get rid of some things to do it, because we've got that talk of recession, we've got that talk of belt tightening, and Walmart does say that the things going on in the economy, inflation and rising interest rates together, are affecting their bottom line. But yeah, I wouldn't take 200 jobs at Walmart as a big sign of anything, but it might be a small sign. But you know, keep in mind, when Walmart sneezes, everyone else in the retail industry gets a cold, and that's what we're seeing. We're seeing other similar companies saying similar things.
Now, if it is a bit of a bellwether here in the U.S. economy, we're going to get this new jobs report tomorrow from July. Companies still hiring across the United States, but it does look like job growth is slowing down, doesn't it?
Yeah. Now, look, in June, we created 372,000 net new jobs, which is actually a lot by any standard. Economists who've been surveyed are expecting 250,000 created in July. So compared to June, that'll be a big drop. But 150,000 to 250,000 jobs in a month is actually a pretty big deal. So, we're in this weird situation where we've got inflation, we've got the Fed raising interest rates at a faster clip than we've seen in recent history, and at the same time, we've got jobs still being created, and we've still got a labor shortage, and we've still got really low unemployment. So we're in this weird situation. Usually when you think you're in a recession, you see a bunch of things happen together. You see the stock market come down, you see unemployment go up. We're not seeing all the ingredients of a recession. So while some people believe we are technically in one, 250,000 jobs, unemployment under 5%, stock market that's gaining, it's very mixed signals, Scott.
It is hard to take a measure of this economy.
Yes.
By the way, Scott is off today. We'll have him back soon. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor. It's okay, but I had to say
look
it.
At that. Next time you have me on, just call me Dave for the entire segment.
No problem. We'll do, Ali. Thanks a lot.
If you wanted to end an early pregnancy in 1960s pre-Roe v. Wade Chicago, there was someone who could help. The Jane Collective, an underground network of mostly young female volunteers, ultimately helped thousands of women get safe, illegal abortions instead of going to back-alley butchers. Seven of the women were arrested. You may have seen the recent HBO documentary telling their story. Here's a clip from the trailer.
We were all being watched.
The phone rings.
A man says, "We know where you are."
There were 11 counts of conspiracy to commit abortion. 110 years for each of us. So that's a long time.
That might have ended Jane right then and there.
Well, the Jane Collective disbanded in 1973 when Roe v. Wade made abortion a protected right. But now that the landmark ruling has been overturned, the Jane Collective's work is getting a reboot under a new name, We Are Jane. Southside activist Tamar Manessa says the new group will partner with Planned Parenthood and the Chicago Abortion Fund to help those with unwanted pregnancies get help where it's still legal, like in Illinois. She joins us now. Welcome, Tamar.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You know, and I have to ask you, Tamar, because people there in Chicago know you're also the founder of the group Mothers Against Senseless Killings, or MASC. I understand MASC happened back in 2015 when you literally set up a lawn chair on a corner where some women had been killed. And you started what is now a barbecue that feeds a lot of the neighborhood children and just looks after kids. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's what we did. There was a mom that was murdered in a drive-by. And 3 days later, on the corner across the street from where she was murdered, we set up our lawn chairs and our barbecue grill. And the work that I've done there has kind of prepared me for this work. I mean, I'm on a corner and we feed all of these children and we make sure they're safe every day. And we do that because there aren't enough other resources in the community that provide that, right? So we really want people to be able to make choices, to plan their families, to be able to make the choice that's really important. Because if someone's faced to have a child in a place where nobody cares about what happens to children once they are born, then what does the neighborhood look like going forward? What does the community look like going forward?
You in Illinois are surrounded by states that are banning abortions after the Supreme Court decision. And you're seeing that influx of these young women needing help into your state. Talk about what We Are Jane will do or does.
We're going to get information out to places where it's banned, where abortion has been banned. The Janes will be in those states, making sure that those young women, those women in those states, they get the information they need to get whatever services it is that they need.
Well, let's explain that part of how this will happen, getting this word out, is you're going to be selling T-shirts, Jane T-shirts, and people can literally put these on and walk through a college campus or a neighborhood that may not have a lot of resources so that what? People will know from that T-shirt that that person can help?
Yeah, you know, it kind of is a tool used to mobilize people who are just enraged. This is the T-shirt. Every time I wear it, I feel activated. I feel like I'm doing something, right? I'm not just waiting until November. I'm doing something now. And I am the messenger. I am the resource. In a place like Missouri, in a place like Mississippi, in a place like Arkansas, I am the resource. I'm disseminating all of this information to young women in other places that may not have access, that may not even know how to get access. But it's really easy if you see someone walking down the street or sitting next to you in a classroom or in the grocery store or your next door neighbor with a Jane shirt or a Jane bumper sticker. You know that is an ally.
Right. I want to be clear. The original Jane Collective, this was before abortion was legal. Some of these young members who'd been anti-war activists, for instance, they actually were taught by doctors how to perform at least early stage abortions because this was all illegal. We want to be clear. Your group is connected with established reproductive health care organizations.
Who provide abortion care.
Right.
We don't do that. We're a little bit different from the originators in that way. But we don't do the actual abortion services. But we make sure we put you in touch with the people who actually do.
Yeah. As you're well aware, abortion is not just illegal in other states, but some states are making it illegal for anyone to assist anyone in getting an abortion. That would be you and other Janes. Are you worried about that?
I'm not. You know, there used to be abolitionists who would actually give quarter to slaves. They would give them shelter. They would hide them. They would do all of these things to assist. That's where we're at again. The fugitive slave laws are still on the books. And just because it's about abortion, it doesn't mean that it's not about dehumanizing someone once again, because that's exactly what's happening to women right now. So in much the vein of the Harriet Tubmans, of Frederick Douglass, I'm there. You might go to jail, but then again, you might save a whole lot of lives.
Well, you were in Mississippi early last month in a Jane T-shirt, and we understand you spoke to a woman who, 24 weeks pregnant, her fetus was seizing in the womb. Tell me about that encounter.
It was a young woman, and it was nothing that anybody could do, because even with this, it's still 26 weeks. There is like a cutoff, and she was like 25 weeks and 3 days, and it was like nothing that could be done. And from what I understand, her doctor wanted to actually do an abortion, but then Roe was overturned, so the doctor couldn't do it. So now you have to carry this baby to term, but knowing this baby that you actually wanted is going to die. It's not going to make it. That is torture for a woman. That is torture for a mother. Torture. And I mean, I think that's one of those side effects that we're going to see from this. You're going to see suicides. You're going to see homicides. You're going to see all of these different things happening because you've thrown us into the world we know nothing about anymore, a world that we shouldn't be in anymore. Nobody should be trying to figure out how to do an abortion at home.
Well, you did what you could do, which was at least, give her a phone number for an out-of-state provider.
Yes, that's all I could do. Now, I don't know what happened after that, and I wish her the best. I'm still praying for her. But it's like, you know, a horrendous story that we're going to keep hearing over and over again, right? You keep hearing about all of these women who are almost bleeding to death and hemorrhaging because, you know, they were having a miscarriage. And, you know, one woman had no more amniotic fluid, but the baby still had a heartbeat. So she almost became septic because she couldn't actually, they wouldn't do a DNC. They wouldn't just go ahead and, you know, evacuate the contents of her uterus. They wouldn't do that. And she almost had to die before they would save her. And we're going to keep hearing about these stories, and they're going to keep getting more and more scary. And it's not going to stop, because it's not like, you know, the Supreme Court is just going to say, you know what, we've done enough. We got abortion overturned. We're finished here. No. They're just getting warmed up.
Look, do you worry? For many women, it's going to be astonishing to see a sea of We Are Jane T-shirts. For some, it's going to be frightening because they need their privacy desperately. It's illegal. And so is there going to be a way to protect, you know, to be discreet for these women and have them just be able to go to the website?
I mean, absolutely. You can do that. Absolutely. If you don't have a sea of Jane T-shirts in banned states, I completely understand. But you need to find some way of letting young people know, of letting women know, period, you are an ally. You're an ally. And I don't know if that's the keychain, if that's the sticker, I'm not clear, but you have to. Considering you don't have these clinics to be the resource anymore, the people have to be the resource, right? So it's not a number you can call. It's not a place you can go. It has to be in the people.
But can they go to the website and discreetly ask for help or look for help?
Absolutely. Sure, they can do that. Absolutely. www.wearejane.org. You can absolutely go there and discreetly get the help you need.
Tamar Manasseh, founder of Mothers Against Senseless Killings, but also behind the relaunching of the 60s Collaborative, the underground network that helped women in Chicago get their health care. The new group is called We Are Jane. We'll have all the information at hereandnow.org. Tamar, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. This has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
A voyage to the bottom of the ocean is reigniting a mystery that has stumped scientists around the world. Who or what is punching holes in neat rows on the seafloor? NOAA scientists spotted the holes last month during a mission to explore an underwater mountain chain called the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. Here's a bit from a video produced by NOAA after the expedition.
They're so perfectly spaced. I mean, why would it always be that spacing?
Deep sea biologist Scott France speaking there. Researchers are so eager to crack this mystery that they're even asking for theories from the public. Michael Vecchione is another NOAA scientist studying these holes, and he is here with us now. Hello.
Hi.
So this is just fascinating. You found these holes more than a mile and a half deep off the coast of the Azores. Describe them for us, because when I look at these pictures, they are so precise that they almost look man-made.
Well, that's one of the remarkable things about them is that they're so consistently precise that you see a bunch of perforations in the bottom, basically extending for some distance in a fairly straight or slightly curved line. Some of these are just about a meter long, and some of them are many meters long, 10, 15 feet long.
Are there animals that can do that?
We don't know of an animal that does this type of pattern. There are animals that burrow and make openings into the bottom. There are other animals that walk along and punch down from the surface to find things to eat, or perhaps to deposit eggs or something like that. We don't know of any animals at this kind of depth, particularly on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which is very poorly explored, that would make these holes.
And you've never seen anything making these holes, so you just don't know. On the other hand, you have collected sediment from the ocean floor and DNA samples from those holes. What do you think that might tell you?
They collected some sediment at the what looked like the freshest end of one of these lines of holes. But when they got it back up to the ship and sorted through it that night, there was no animal in the sample that would be a suspect as far as making the holes are concerned. However, they also collected a water sample to look for DNA evidence. It's called environmental DNA or eDNA. What's going on there is that animals shed cells or mucus that they've produced and things like that that have their DNA in it. And that floats around in the water. And if you collect that and amplify the DNA in it, you can come up with sequences for any of the animals that may be in the area there. And you might be able to identify them if you've already got matching sequences from an animal that you know what it is.
So as you wait for the results from those tests, you've gone to social media and asked for ideas from the public. But why bother asking people like me? I mean, we have no idea what this is.
Well, we don't know what it is either, but we've gotten quite a wide variety of suggestions.
Like what?
Well, I'm looking for something that actually matches all the facts that we know about this. And some of the things that I hadn't thought about were the suggestion that an animal might have gone along laying eggs in the sediment and that those holes are a result of the hatching of the eggs. I just got an email right before we started talking from an emeritus professor in the University of California system. He's a geologist and works on earthquakes. And he pointed out that when an earthquake occurs in an area where the rock is cracked, that can cause puffing up of the sediment and cause little mini volcano-looking things similar to what we see. Although that doesn't explain the regularity of what we see.
I see. So maybe you're looking for more input from professionals, not just people like me who say maybe it's an alien who's infiltrating the bottom of the ocean. I think we should say that this is not the first time that something like this has ever been documented. In the early 2000s, scientists spotted similar holes in a nearby area. What is it about this mystery that's so important to you as a scientist? Why do you want to figure it out so badly?
Well, I was one of those scientists in 2004 that saw those holes when we were doing initial exploration of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And seeing those holes resulted in one of those, what in the hell is that moments? We just didn't know. When we saw them in 2004, we saw them basically at just one location. But now with the new dives, we know that they're in multiple locations, that there are a lot of them when you see the right conditions. So this is probably something important in the ecology of the mid-ocean ridge system. And we just don't really know what's going on there.
It does make you wonder what else might be lurking at the bottom of the ocean floor. This is an area, you don't need me to tell you, that we know so little about. It is so remote and distant.
Yeah, it's not only that, it's part of the deep sea, which is the largest living space on our planet. And the deeper you go, the farther away from where we live you go, the less we know about it.
Michael Vecchione is with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. We're going to link you to the videos and some pictures of these holes at hereandnow.org. You can send Michael your own ideas about what it might be. Thank you so much. Great to speak with you. Good luck.
Well, I appreciate your interest.
I don't know. I still say it's an alien.
Now I have to worry about holes in the ocean floor. Put that on my list. An alien. Oh my.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR and Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now.